Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, today I am so excited because I am based in Phoenix, Arizona, and most of my guests seem to be elsewhere, but I have a friend today who's another local, Patrick Milliken. Patrick is a bookseller at the world-famous Poison Pen bookstore in Scottsdale and a freelance writer and editor. He is the editor of the anthologies Phoenix Noir and The Highway Kind, Tales of Fast Cars, Desperate Drivers, and Dark Roads. And his work has appeared in Publishers Weekly, Los Angeles Review of Books, and other publications. A longtime devotee of noir fiction, Milliken leads a popular book group called the Hardboiled Discussion Group, now in its 24th year. Patrick, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, just I've been spending the last couple of days, catching up on William Lindsay Gresham and rereading the book and watching both the movies. And
yeah,
it's been a lot of fun.
Very cool. I was excited when you suggested this. This was the first time I ever read the book. And is this one of your favorite novels?
Absolutely. Definitely in my top 10. Noirs of all time.
It's fascinating. It's so shocking that it was written then, and it still feels just like, you know, completely, even though it's dated, it feels current. The stakes are completely, even though we're talking about carnies, we might as well be talking about Hollywood or politics. It's a great one. Yeah.
Absolutely. I know it's one of those books. It's funny with my discussion group at the bookstore.
Yeah.
It's the only book that we've actually read twice over the last, 24 years.
Wow.
Yep. And for some reason, it's such an interesting, odd creation. You know, there's really nothing like it that I've found. And what one of the things that always interests me about noir fiction in particular, and this point in time, you got writers like David Goodis and, of course, Jim Thompson, people like that, who are really just pursuing their own personal demons on the page.
Yeah.
You know, sort of loosely draped in a crime novel format. And you definitely get this here, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you're dealing with an alcoholic and all of the different things he's tried to go through in his own life with, 12 steps, psychotherapy, tarot, all of it. And I read that he first got the idea when he was over in the Spanish Civil War. Yeah, volunteering and talked to a carny who was another volunteer. And sometimes that's what happens. You meet your main character or you meet somebody and they spark an idea. Yeah.
Yeah. He was so horrified by this story about the geek.
Yes.
Which we can get into a little bit. The horrors of, alcohol and other, other substances, the withdrawals from that, play such a role in it.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those where you can see the end coming because that's how it begins, but it's still shocking and you still have no idea how you're going to get to that ending. Right. And I also love how both of the films, I mean, the first one, the 1947 version, has such a great line there about, you know, Mr. I was made for it, I think is the line. And we hear something, we might hear the exact same line in the new version. I can't remember for sure, but it's very close. And how they just kind of, you know, they honored the subject, they honored the source material, but yeah, of course, you know, the original, which I love, the classic movie, of course, but they were pressured by the studio and Zanuck to kind of put a little sunlight on there. But you can still, people watching at the time, I'm sure, knew exactly where it was really supposed to end. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember, because I hadn't seen the new one until just now.
Okay.
And so my only view of it was obviously the original 1947, right? 47 mm-hmm. film. And it's amazing. They really are two different beasts.
They are. You know? Yeah.
Both of them. I love both of them.
Yes. For different reasons. Yeah.
For different reasons. And there are some structural things that they do differently. Mm-hmm. You know, in the new version of it, you know, I was thinking about it while watching the new one, and the aesthetic of it and the cinematography of the film
was
so incredible, and the set design. Yep. And I could have, you know, I said if only they could have gotten Tom Waits to do the film score, it would have been absolutely perfect.
Yes. Yeah, I was telling Patrick, and actually yesterday I exchanged some messages with Kim Morgan, who is the co-screenwriter, Guillermo del Toro's wife. She's an old colleague of mine, or another critic, master writer on cinema and a scholar. She was the co-screenwriter of the new one. And I heard from her yesterday, it was, as we're recording this, it was her birthday. She shares a birthday with Marilyn. And so we were talking, and she was apologizing that she was too busy. They were working on, I think it's the new Frankenstein, for the next film that Guillermo was working on, and she had some deadlines. But I think she will love that we are talking about it, because she is a noir scholar, and yeah, you can tell that this was made with love. It's so his aesthetics and the people that he collaborates with. And how much they adore the old one. She actually wrote the essay that is in the Criterion Blu-ray edition. It's a remarkable essay. I think you guys, if you're listening and you don't own the Criterion collection, it's online as well. But yeah, I highly recommend her essay to you. Yeah.
So what was, I'm really curious, because you're the film expert. What was your take on, you know, after you read the book just recently, right, for the first time?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what you thought of the spirit of the book, and, you know, sort of how each movie captured it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I was not prepared for how much happens after we leave the carnival world. Because I think I didn't remember, or I wasn't anticipating that he was going to become the Reverend Stanton.
Yes.
That whole section, it's different in the classic film. And I'd seen the new version, but I saw it for the last time a couple years ago. So it had been a while for me. So I knew like some of the broad strokes and stuff, but I was not prepared for that. I thought that was rich. I was glad we learned more about the Molly character, because we didn't really get much of that in the films. You know, the actresses are, I like the ensemble cast in both films, but I was glad to know more about her. Also, maybe the motives or what was going on a little bit more with the therapist, and his own backstory. I found it really rich. It kind of, I will say that it lost me a little bit in the transition from, you know, the code act to the spiritual thing that they were doing, the medium, and then finally the swindle. It seemed that kind of started to lose me slightly, but then by the last section of the book, you're back in it for sure.
Right. And of course, and I was thinking about, you know, again, what they could and couldn't. I think in some ways, the newer version is much truer to the original book.
Yeah, or the spirit of it, for sure.
The spirit of it. And they did a great job of, you know, because the book itself is full of all sorts of, there's a lot of sex in the book.
Yeah.
You know, some of it implied, a lot of it off stage.
I know. And the phrasing is very modern. Like, you're like, whoa, yes. They were talking about that and using those language, that kind of language, right in the mid 40s. Yes.
Right. And I was also thinking about, you know, with Tyrone Power, you know, having him as the star.
Oh, and he was phenomenal. That's his favorite role.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he said it was the best film he was in, and that was his best. And I agree, it's up there. Or it's at least in the top, you know, two or so. Yeah.
Right. In the new, you know, the structural kind of stuff that, and again, I suppose there are spoilers here, but that's not.
No, I think it makes the conversation richer.
I'm used to, I'm used to in my normal role at the bookstore being very careful about giving away spoilers, but I don't have to do that here, do I?
No.
Okay, good. Well, spoiler alert, people. In the new, you know, in the new version, it opens with Stan at the house, at his father's house. And, you know, he ends up killing his father, essentially.
Yeah.
Did you get
and
that?
We didn't. Yeah. And we didn't, like, there were images that we kept seeing kind of cut back in, and we weren't sure exactly what. And then, yeah.
Right. And then so that's done slightly a little bit different sequentially in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, when we first meet Stan in the original film version, he's already at the carny.
Yes.
And he's already part of the act. And in this, in the new version, we see the very dramatic kind of burning house sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it reminded me a little bit of Sling Blade.
A little bit. Yeah.
Some of the same dynamics, but and then he joins the carny, and we witness that that whole process in the new book,
mm-hmm.
and the way Xena and Pete are introduced in the new version, and by the way, I thought Toni Collette, right, who played
Xena.
Oh,
I love her. Yeah,
she was absolutely fantastic. You know?
She added more humanity. I think she, yes. Well, you can see that a little bit. And I love Joan Blondell, of course, but I liked the change. There was a little bit more to Xena. She wasn't, I'm not saying she was more femme fatale in the older version. Yeah.
Right. And just the whole sort of, I don't know.
They're almost like his parents in the new version of Bradley Cooper, like his new substitute carny family.
Right.
Like in a weird way. Yeah.
in a weird sexual way.
Yes. Which is kind of all over the book and the films. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, there's a lot of, in his background, mm-hmm. you know, he's got big time mommy issues.
Yeah.
As it comes out later with the psychologist.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. I love that you brought up Sling Blade, because you can totally see like Billy Bob Thornton loving this book. I mean, I would imagine maybe this would have been something that appealed to him way back in the day. And I read that Ron Perlman was actually the one that gave, I think it was Del Toro, the book, like way back.
Is that right?
Yeah, in the early 90s. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the cast, you know, the cast of the cast of the new version was so inspired. I mean,
yeah, I know.
Willem Dafoe character.
Perfect.
You know, absolutely perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the new version, they really capture the horrors of the geek and what the geek is going
yes.
through.
Yes. Yeah, it's more devastating.
Much more explicitly.
And yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear the moaning and the screaming and the suffering and anguish, which, you know, kind of goes through Del Toro's filmography and his own interests. And you can see like this came after Shape of Water, and you almost needed Shape of Water for him to make this movie. Yeah.
I wanted to get your thoughts on, So this book was, the book was published in 1946, right?
Yeah.
And the movie came out the next year. And I was just thinking about, you know, we talk about this a lot in our discussion group and about noir, about that period and how it comes in, you know, no coincidence right after the war.
Yeah.
And you get all these soldiers coming back home from the war, mm-hmm. who are dealing with all sorts of trauma. Or if not our, you know, because I think they say the majority of World War II vets never saw combat, but still they come back and, you know, and their eyes are opened. This is a different world, you know, and it's kind of like the whole country loses its innocence, you know? And, so, you know, I've heard Eddie Muller talk about this and other people that they came home from the war really with the hunger for more adult themed material, you know,
yeah.
the usual kind mm-hmm. of bullshit, you know, sap story.
For sure. Yeah. On the Criterion disc, there's a really good like 30-minute interview with Imogen Sarah Smith, who wrote, you know, a remarkable book on noir. She's a noir expert, friend of Eddie Muller's. And she was talking about how subversive that is, because, you know, you think back of World War II in modern times, and you think it's innocence in America with suburbia and Man in the Gray Flannels. It wasn't like that. I mean, it was very subversive that these films took hold. I mean, you had like the musicals, you had other forms of entertainment, but then you had these as well, and you had people who were in the war or looking for this, like Tyrone Power famously asked Daryl Zanuck to buy the rights to this. He was tired of just being you know, that one-dimensional hero character, and so he wanted this part and loved the book. And I read, or maybe it was Imogen, talked about that what was shocking, because the book had been out, they did get a bunch of mail, but the people weren't that worried about the sex or the violence or the darkness. It was the religion angle. That was the thing that was like scaring them about, sure. Ooh, he's cynical about religion.
Right.
And so that was almost more shocking. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was going to bring up a similar point that, you know, so this whole generation, we're going into the Norman Rockwell kind of sanitized facade of America.
Yep.
And so much of what noir develops is, of course, the reality underneath that facade.
Mm-hmm.
But people were coming back, maybe looking for answers, looking for relief
mm-hmm.
in different ways. And, you know, of course, booze is the classic form of relief. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of what you hear about that generation as well, they didn't talk about it, you know.
Yep. Yeah. My grandpa was, didn't talk about it. Yep.
They drank it. But also, like, you have to check me on this, but wasn't, you know, some of these religious organizations that were starting to come up, like Billy mm-hmm. Graham.
Yeah.
And, you know, were coming up. I don't know the exact time, but I know they became very big and popular post-war.
And the, like, to talk about Gresham, Dianetics in the 50s, that was another thing he explored. So yeah, they were starting to take root. People were looking for that. I think it was, again, Imogen Sarah Smith said, instead of the American dream, that's why it's called Nightmare Alley. It's the the inverted dream. Like, it's not, it's a nightmare. Yeah. American nightmare. Yep.
And I like how, I think it was Nick Toshis in his, or Toshis, however he says it,
mm-hmm.
who is a fascinating character in his own right.
Yes.
and I heard somewhere that he was working on a biography of Gresham.
Oh, wow. That would be interesting. Yeah.
That may be old news. But somewhere in there, you know, he talks about how, you know, Gresham, you know, was a real seeker, you know, and he in his own life was seeking these mm-hmm. different, he had a tormented mind and was seeking solutions and all these different things, psychology. And as you say, he knew he was an alcoholic early on
mm-hmm.
and all those different things. And then his second wife left him for C.S. Lewis, man.
Whoa.
I know.
Oh my God. Was she the Shadowlands? Was that her?
She was indeed.
Oh, I was thinking I wanted to rewatch that movie because it's been forever, but now I'm going to have to. Yes.
Yeah, Lois. I think her name was Lois Gresham.
Wow.
I think that's right. I'll have to check
She's
that.
Like, enough with Nightmare Alley. We're going for the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Exactly.
Yep.
She's stepping up a bit, right?
Yeah, enough nightmares. Yes. I was going to ask you, he wrote one other book. I know he wrote some nonfiction and stuff, but
yeah.
What was that one like?
There it is. And I'm embarrassed
What a
to say.
great title, Limbo Tower.
Limbo
I love that.
Tower. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it.
Oh, that's fine.
I need to, though. But this is the one. Here's the original.
Ooh, very cool.
Yeah. And it's interesting how they emphasize that, you know, the whole alley motif rather than the carny necessarily. They got the hanged man upside down here.
Yeah.
And I also have a copy of his.
Ooh.
So I don't know. He, as a character, he really fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised there hasn't been a film about him. Yeah. Or an extensive bio. Yeah.
Right.
Although he said, was it Stan is the author? Wasn't that his line about Nightmare Alley? That, yeah.
Right. What was I going to say? Well, the whole, you know, they get into, he introduces people to this whole, you know, this new language, this new lexicon of the carny, of the, mm-hmm. of the underworld, which is really specific. And you can tell he really did his homework with this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He interviewed so many people and made sure that he was in it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the whole riff on sleight of hand and, you know, the details about misdirection mm-hmm. and, you know, the number codes is all interesting, you know, this sort of very specific skill set. But at the heart of it all is, you know, human nature, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. What did you think about the differences in the women and how they were portrayed in the two different versions, Xena and Mary and Lilith?
Yeah. Well,
lots of strong female characters there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kate Blanchett. Absolutely yes. incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I think the two, you know, I was going to compare all these kind of side by side and see which one.
Yeah.
I thought that who was the woman that played Lilith in the original version? I can't remember her name, but.
Helen Walker.
Helen Walker.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was great in the original version.
Ooh, she was. Definitely like a noir femme fatale, the way she was playing that. Like, yep, by the end, she almost turns into Elizabeth Scott kind of character. Yes.
But I thought they were both really strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think I was telling you before we got started about how I saw the screening of the movie. I don't know. I can't remember. It was at least 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. Because it was at the, oh gosh, it was on Hollywood Boulevard, one of the old theaters there. And Eddie Muller introduced it. And it was not long. I think he had his book, Dark City Dames, coming out.
Okay.
Either right
yeah.
After that, which, what a gold mine. It's so great that he was able to capture, mm-hmm. you know, for all those.
Yeah, that's on my bookshelf up there. Yes, absolutely.
Passed away. But Colleen Gray, who played Elektra, Molly,
mm-hmm.
she was there, and he interviewed her after the screening. Did you have a preference between the two? I think I may prefer the new one, but
oh really? You know, it's hard. I was leaning more towards I love Rooney Mara as an actress, but I was kind of leaning more towards Colleen Gray. I like what she did with her voice a little bit more.
Okay.
But I think in the new one, we saw more internal wheels turning, which I liked. So they had different things to play on. Yeah.
They both, I think, captured it really well.
Yeah, for sure.
As far as Xena goes, I got to say I prefer Toni Collette.
I love what they did with her. I mean, I'm a huge Joan Blondell fan, but I like what they did with Xena more in the new one. And I kind of liked this idea of her and Pete sort of being, I mean, she's coming on to Bradley Cooper right away, but also kind of weirdly like his parents, which was strange. But yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And we learn a lot more, of course, about his parents in the book. Mm-hmm. and kind of the background he came from. With Tony, there was just so much raw sexuality there that they couldn't show in the original version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How did you like Bradley Cooper? Did you think he did a decent job?
I do. I remember when I saw this, it was really funny. It was for voting duties for the Phoenix Critics Society. Like in the same day, we had like a timed window. We had to watch this. And then the film right after it was Licorice Pizza, which also had Bradley Cooper in it. And so side by side, I was leaning more towards, God, I love what he did in Licorice Pizza. But watching it now with those movies separated, I do really like what Bradley Cooper brought to this. He produced it. Del Toro talks about how important of a collaborator he was. And he said he loved working with him after he had directed, because he said actors are a form of directors already, and directors are also actors. And he said, but because he had those skill sets, he was able to be like a really valuable collaborator for him. So I actually thought, yeah, he was very good. I lean more towards Power, because I think Power really kind of leaned into the sinister a little bit more. I don't know if it's the black and white and the angle of the film, but I thought Cooper's great. How about you?
I liked, I was preparing not to like Cooper for some reason. And I ended up really liking him. I liked the way he played it. I think I just haven't particularly cared for some of the other stuff he's done.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
But no, I thought he was very good. I really liked Tyrone Power. And it's interesting what you said, which I didn't know, that he sort of championed this project from the very beginning. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. He loved the book. He wanted to do something that really showed range. And it was one of those where Zanuck said, oh, no, it's too dark or whatever. And then when it didn't open super wide, I think then they took it out of some theaters. And so it was able to be more of a I told you so to Tyrone Power. But he was still really proud of the performance and like to the day he died. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he has a right to be, for sure. Yeah. He didn't want to be known as just a pretty face, which is kind of, I think, Cooper wanting to get into directing and do, he doesn't want to just be seen as a pretty face. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He replaced DiCaprio. DiCaprio early on was supposed to be in it. And I don't know if it was a scheduling thing or he backed out, but then Cooper stepped in. I know Michael Shannon, it was a scheduling thing. I can't remember who he was supposed to play though, but yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. So Leo was attached to it early on?
Leo was. I mean, isn't every movie lately like, oh, Leo's going to be in it. Like Leo's going to play Sinatra. Leo's going to play. It's like, yes, but he was kind of attached. Yeah. I'm glad. I think sometimes, I mean, he's phenomenal, but I think his personality or the movie star, it, would have stolen too much focus, and you want to get lost into this world, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you about, the whole, look at my little notes here. Stan, the whole thing seems very contemporary. Although it's, of course, there are still carnies out there. Mm-hmm. traveling carnies. In fact, one of the ladies I used to work with grew up working in a carny, a traveling carny.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. But what do you think Stan, what would he be today if this took place today? A lot of options, aren't there?
You know, I'm going to lean towards, I don't know, that's really hard. You don't want to get too political with it. Would he be in that arena? But some sort of showmanship thing. He could be a podcast personality, anything where he could be a televent, you know, something to influence. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly what I was thinking, that he could be one of these televangelist kind
of mega church guy,
charlatans, or a wellness guru of some sort.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, peddling some sort of cure, cult leader, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about Pete and the way that played out. I loved, I think David Strathairn is one of our great actors. So I was really excited to see him in the new one. Like immediately when you see him, you just feel kind of protective. I don't know if it's decades of watching him and everything from like Sneakers and The River Wild and all these movies, but.
LA Confidential and.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Edward R. Murrow and
Good Night and Good Luck. So good.
Mm-hmm. Now, he's a wonderful actor. I thought he did a really good job. I thought the original one was great, though.
Oh, so good. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know who the actor was, but you could tell he was like a trained, perhaps a trained stage actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole riff of the guy who was once on top, you know, and once.
I loved that. Yeah.
And that's very noir, you know.
Yes.
You know, through a series of, you know.
Ian Key was the original. Okay.
And he was wonderful.
Yeah.
He had a real presence about him.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, one of those, you know, the phrases, we had faces then, one of those guys.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. I could easily see him as, you know, or I pictured somebody like Lon Chaney or somebody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And his voice and everything. No, I thought he was terrific. Let's talk a little bit, not to hijack the conversation, but.
Oh, no, go for it.
I just wanted to pick your brain on stuff because I'm much better versed in the book world and doing, you know, book analysis. I love film too. I'm just not that as knowledgeable. And.
Oh, no, but you're a fan. That's what, yeah.
Aesthetically speaking, the two. You know, have different approaches to, again, I thought in the new version, the set design was just extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, your jaw is on the floor. It's everything is so stylized. And I read that it was mostly shot, I want to say in Toronto, but then some of it was shot in upstate New York, which I think Del Toro said he had not been to this area, and he wanted a world that was going to feel very original that we didn't see on film a million times. Mm. And I think, you know, it is so singular and what he can do. I mean, this is a movie where he actually shut down production in March of 2020 before Disney, which owns Searchlight, did for COVID. He just knew, like, if we continue on, someone's going to get sick, so we better shut it down. So the joke was, like, we went to lunch and came back 6 months later. So they had to shoot the second half of the film first because of a scheduling thing. They didn't want to do that with this because of the progression of the characters. But I think, you know, really getting into the headspace. I think he said it was like 2.5 years of his life, and he takes it so seriously on all aspects and the people he collaborates with. I mean, he's kind of one of those like Argento level masters that, or Tim Burton, like you feel like you're in good hands. It is a full on world that you are stepping into. And so it's as much as I love the look of the old black and white one and the carnival world, seeing just the opulent the costuming. And also when we leave the carnival world and they're playing in these clubs and then, the whole layout of Kate Blanchett's office was
Oh my
so
God,
good. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
it's just stunning.
Yeah, because she's another person who has a racket, essentially. And I love how, she's recording conversations and the level of, you could just imagine that every part of that set probably did practically work. Last week, I talked about Hunt for Red October. I was a guest on someone's podcast. And when I was doing the research, I guess they had working dials. Like they've built a sub down to the working gauges and dials. You can kind of imagine when you're watching Nightmare Alley that, everything in the jar there, we see all the jars at the carnival, the strange stuff they have everywhere. Like you can imagine them poring over each thing to make sure it looks perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, the I was just thinking about the state, the state fair that
Yeah.
comes here to Phoenix every year in October. It's within walking distance from where we live downtown, and so my wife and I sometimes will wander over there and just kind of wander through because it's fascinating. And they, I'm just thinking about the aesthetics, and obviously most of it's printed signs and. And what I loved about this is that everything is hand painted and hand crafted,
Yeah,
and just
even if it's miniatures, it feels practical and not CG as much. Yeah.
and there's a I can't remember the scene, but where they show the eye with all the little eyes. Do you remember what I'm
Yes.
talking about? What? Yeah, just the attention to detail, and
Yeah.
also the they have the guy playing the parlor guitar, and he's playing like this sort of Piedmont style rag that would have been very appropriate for that time period. Just those kind of details are really sold it for me.
And it's a film that when you look at the budget, I can't remember. I think it might have been, let me take a look because I am curious on that.
And
You would
it's sort of
imagine it would cost like twice that much.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, the budget was 60 million, and you could imagine. So you kind of think some of those actors for sure took pay cuts to work with Del Toro and just to be a part of it. But also, you could imagine this movie costing, double that for sure. I mean, budgets have gotten kind of out of control on some other films, but this movie, like for what he was able to create, like, yeah, you feel like you are stepping in a totally different world. And, thinking about what you were saying about what would it be like today, I mean, actors always call their own world, like, I wrote an article about Defoe, who's one of my favorite actors. And in interviews, he repeatedly calls himself a nomad. And a lot of actors will say, like, yeah, we're carny people or we're circus people because they leave on a moment's notice. Like, we can get a call, blank fell out, we need somebody, and they have to leave. And so you can kind of see, like, actors would. Even though, I mean, it's just putting on a show. It's playing to the crowds. And so I can kind of see that, they say every movie is really about show business, that this would have appealed to a lot of people on that level. Yeah, I think.
Every movie is about show business. That's a
There's
great quote.
kind of a, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I buy that, but yeah. But
Yeah,
that's
right.
what they
It
say. Yes.
sounds good. It's a good,
Yeah.
yeah. What fascinates me, there's so much well, do you know at what point, like the carny or the fair became less about these sideshow curiosities and more about rides and things like that? Did that not come into play until
I
maybe
would
the
think
60s?
that's what I would guess. Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting. Like the old traveling medicine shows,
Yeah, in the 20s and the 30s. Yeah, the
And the, some of the,
Cures.
right, yeah, the health tonics and things like that. Do you know Joe Lansdale, the writer, at all?
I know the
Have you
name,
met?
but I don't know him. No.
When he comes, you're going to have to set something up with him.
Okay.
because he comes from a town in Texas called Nacogdoches. And it was one of the crossroads for all these traveling carny shows.
Oh, wow.
And some of that was still going on when he was growing up. And so a lot of his books deal with this really interesting mix of, drive-in movie theaters, B-movies, carnies, all that. And it's such an interesting thing.
Our friend Megan Abbott at one time was researching carnies and stuff. So I was wondering if that might be a project in the future. Yeah.
Oh, really? She was?
Yeah, she should call Joe. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, she knows him, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But, the whole revival aspect of these early shows, revival meetings and carnies are very similar in what their aims are. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said this is one of your top 10 noir books.
Definitely.
For those listening, because I love having people on who love and know noir as much as you do, what are some of your other ones? Like people listening who might enjoy Nightmare Alley, maybe they haven't read the book, but like what other ones would you recommend people seek out if they're just getting into noir or kind of like these sort of things? Yeah.
Well, I think you'd have to do a Jim Thompson. I would think that
Do you have a favorite? Killer Inside Me,
probably. Pop 1280 are both really favorites, but there's so many good ones. And then you'd probably want to do a David Goodis, I think, would be up there. Which one, though? I'm not sure. I mean, there's so many of them I really like. There's one called Cassidy's Girl that I think is a great, a personal favorite. And let's see, I would definitely pick a Chester Himes.
Okay.
Just for something different. He wrote that wonderful Harlem Domestic series with his characters were Coffin Ed and Gravedigger Jones. Sort of this surreal, absurdist landscape of Harlem in the 50s and 60s. So I would definitely pick one of those. I'm not sure which one. And let's see, one of my favorites, and it's also been reprinted by New York Review of Books, who I love. The book is by Elliot Chase and, what's it called again? I'll look it up real quick.
Sure.
Elliot Chase. Yeah, it's an absolute classic. But then I think you'd have to read, at least one Raymond Chandler. I
mean, my favorite. Hammett. Yeah.
Yeah. Chandler and a Hammett, maybe. James M. Cain.
Yeah.
Probably Double Indemnity. Postman Always Rings Twice. It's interesting in my group, we started out at the very beginning of the genre with the Hammetts and the Chandlers and those folks, and then slowly made our way forward. Sequentially in time. And it's really interesting to kind of look at society reflected through these different crime novels. Once you get into the 60s, all of a sudden things start to change and, the cops are no longer the heroes. And I think in one of your podcasts, you brought up Cutter's Way.
Yes. Yeah, I was talking to Dwayne Hrzynski about it.
Yeah, I was listening to that. And that's one of my favorites. And the book, Cutter and Bone, is one of my favorites by Newton Thornburg. Mm-hmm. The Elliot Chase book, it just came to me, is called Black Wings Has My Angel.
Okay. And,
yeah, you should check it out. I think you'd love it.
Very good.
And then Dorothy B. Hughes in A Lonely Place, I think, is one of the great noir novels, certainly. But there's just so many.
Yeah, I read my first Charles Williams. My friend Travis Woods loves the movie The Hot Spot. And so he was getting everyone. And I loved his writing style, too.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to have to crash one of these or join your group here. And especially when you guys do one that has a film tie-in, that would be a lot of fun. Yeah
there's so many. So many that do.
What is your next upcoming one for people listening? Is it a thing they can like watch the YouTube? Do you have anything like that?
We're pretty old school in that we were doing a hybrid meeting where it was Zoom and in person. And then it just became just too much of a
pain. Yeah.
But and so it's right now it's just an in-person group at the bookstore. But
well,
I may
then you're a destination is what we're saying. So, you know,
That's
check
right.
the Poison Pen website. And when Patrick is doing one of your favorites, come to Scottsdale. Yeah.
That's right. And we're doing, we may reconsider that and start doing a Zoom format.
Or like an addendum. Yeah.
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 So actually the next a podcast, right? Mm-hmm. The next one book we're going to be doing is Raymond Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely.
Oh, great one.
Yeah. And that's also one of my favorite noir films, the adaptation from the 70s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Robert Mitchum.
Mitchum.
Mm-hmm. And the wonderful Charlotte Rampling and the cameo by Jim Thompson. I'd love to talk about that film with you at some point too. Have
For
you seen
sure.
That?
Yeah, we can. That'll be our next one. We can read it. And I've read it, but it's been a while. But I was going to ask you about what you thought of the screenplays, especially I love the new one. I'm biased, of course, because you know, Kim is so great and I know her, but I love the original script by Jules Furthman, who was one of the writers of Rio Bravo and wrote so many just classic movies. I love the one-liners he gives people, like we were talking about the last line of, you know, I was made for it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the perfect way to end the film.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that when I rewatched the original, we watched it last night and my wife and I were, you know, and that was just coming off watching the newer version.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of keen to kind of study where they departed, which one did what. And it is interesting that the last line in the original version is somebody says, "How could a man sink so low?"
Mm-hmm.
He reached too high. You know, it's that,
yes.
That's that thing. And
yeah, where they have to announce the theme a little. That might have been
exactly
a Hollywood mandate.
In case you didn't get it. This is the danger of doing this. But also that in the book, certainly, and in the mm-hmm. second version, there's no reunion with Molly.
No.
You know, Molly doesn't see him.
Mm-mm.
And there's some, in the original version, there is some lingering thing of, okay, well, now Molly's going to take care of him, kind of in the same way that Xena took care of Pete.
It's a little cyclical, which I like. Yeah.
Right. Which doesn't happen in the book. It doesn't mm-hmm. happen in the new version.
Mm-hmm.
But both of them work. I thought the screenplay was really good. You know, I think in both, the new one, I think was much truer to the book. I'm just trying to think of some of the other things that.
What about Grindel? What did you think there?
Grindel, yeah.
Yeah.
Grindel. I thought the actor that in the new version was outstanding.
Oh, Richard Jenkins, who just got cast in what my friend Jordan Harper is making Criminal with Ed Brubaker, and they just got Richard Jenkins. So I was very excited. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Mm-hmm. No, I thought he was great. I thought the guy that played in the original version was really quite good, too.
Yeah.
They were both good. I thought aesthetically, the way the two scenes were shot was different, you know?
Obviously. Yeah, the blood and the
blood.
Oh my gosh. I like that Del Toro loves to blend his genres. This is the one that doesn't involve, I mean, you're dealing with the idea of magic, but it isn't like with Shape of Water. He blends gothic and noir and fantasy and all kinds of things and science fiction. And then this one, that's where some of the gothic overtones come in. And I thought that worked really well. And also they made it more dangerous. Like we see it register in Cooper's face, like what this man did. And I liked that. Yeah, that reveal. Yeah.
So the original, I think the backstory in the book is that
back alley Dory, abortion. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Dory, he knocked up Dory and then, right.
Talked her in getting the abortion and she died. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And in the original film version, you know, the way she's dressed is very different. You know, she's kind of.
Yeah. And we don't really know what, because they couldn't like implicitly say, hey, you know,
cover her with blood. Right.
Yeah. Or this is what happened. The abortion, like it's all, you know, you don't really explained. Know what he did. Yeah. And then the new
which
one.
Which has its
scarier.
Which has its charm, though.
Yes. I think
the original, the suggestion has its charm.
Yeah.
But also knowing is good, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I thought they were both great. What else can we compare? Well,
if you're programming, how about if you're programming like a film festival, what movies would you put with these, maybe? You have any ideas? That's hard. Yeah.
That's a really tough one. I don't know. Do you?
We can skip over that one.
You're the one that has the.
Yeah.
Has the, maybe Freaks.
I was going to say, yeah, you can see Freaks with, put Freaks with the original. And then I think you'd have to put Shape of Water with okay. Nightmare. Also, maybe Crimson Peak. Did you see that one?
No,
it's,
I did not.
Del Toro, it's more gothic. And I think if you made like a triple of those three, yeah, that might be interesting. Yeah.
Did you have a sense of, from reading the book, about the whole alley, the whole alley metaphor and what that kind of represents in the book? He mentions it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Different, you know.
Maybe
like
going down... Once you head down there, or what did you think?
Well,
it's easy to get detoured. I don't know.
I think it occurred in this great edition.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs a couple of times. And he says here on page 59, it says, a third of, okay, how helpless they all looked in the ugliness of sleep. And, a third of life spent unconscious and corpse-like, and some, the great majority, stumbled through their waking hours, scarcely more awake, helpless in the face of destiny. They stumbled down a dark alley towards their deaths. They sent exploring feelers into the light and met fire and writhed back again into the darkness of their blind groping.
Ooh, yeah, that's really, beautifully
really
written. You know, I was going to ask you that with Stan. I liked that in the old one, how he gets the wool pulled over his eyes, you know, like, how did you know that about my dog? The cold reading idea. And it kind of shows mm-hmm. you he might think he's being smarter than everyone and everyone is, you know, these suckers that he is playing. But he was susceptible and it kind of foreshadows maybe he would be someone who would be susceptible again, too. Yeah.
And also it opens his eyes on how to do it.
Yes. You know? Yeah. But then he gets really cocky about it and thinks,
does.
Yeah, the Lilith idea, which is kind of your classic noir setup. Yeah.
I was interested in the sort of, you know, getting a little bit deeper into the spiritualism angle
yeah.
in the book that isn't really shown in either film. You know?
No. Oh, my goodness. The new version with Mary Steenburgen and that.
That's an amazing scene.
That was so shocking. Yes.
Your smile.
Yes.
Yeah, yep. No, that was great.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about how the whole, yeah, he becomes an ordained minister.
Yep.
From, you know, some rinky-dink spiritualist church by mail, kind of mm-hmm. a crackerjack box ordination sort of thing.
Yeah.
But how the racket that he gets into with Molly sort of later in the book anyway, it's changed slightly. It's somewhat of the same thing, but he's using, it's the classic con of using her as the medium through which this spirit speaks, actually mm-hmm. speaks. And they get in, he summons the voice of Ramakrishna in the book, and mm-hmm. they do that. And I was just thinking, that con is going on to this day.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I was at, it's funny, my wife and I went on this Alaskan cruise, which was somewhat of a nightmarish experience, but.
I'm so scared of cruises, personally. Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was our first and probably last experience.
Oh, no.
I mean, the whole aesthetic.
But it would be gorgeous, at least, Alaska.
Yeah, it was nice. But on the boat was this mm-hmm. This spiritual guide. And she summons this being, channels this being. I think its name is Solomon or something like okay. that. I mean, she's really popular.
Oh,
and
wow.
So there are a bunch of people on board that were attending her little sessions. And that's her same racket. I mean, she'd go into this trance. We didn't see it, you know?
Yeah.
But after I got home, I looked her up and I looked up some videos. And it's exactly what he describes in this book. You know, she'll summon yeah. the spirit. And then she'll go into this sort of, you know, very monotone voice. I am speaking for, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow.
Yeah, they know how to play and they know how to do it. I've told this story on the podcast. I think I did an episode on like movies with magic in the past, but my first weird experience with a magician, I was 17. I was at a restaurant with my parents, and this magician was supposed to do a party, I think, at a nearby table. And he was early, or they weren't there yet. And he just like walked over to the table, said, "Can I do magic for you?" And asked me, and my dad was immediately excited. Yes. And so the magician was doing, and then, you know, everybody is watching and he's playing to everybody, but he's kind of handsy and being a little creepy with me. And by the end, he made some kind of joke like, "Well, if I, you know, if I get this, then you should go out with me," or something like that. And I said I was 17 and whatever. And then later, when I was like walking to the restroom, his party came and he charmed the entire room again. And over at that table, he like followed me down the hall and he said, "Okay, now that I'm away from your parents, like, are you going to give me your phone number?" And he'd been so creepy that I was, I guess, a little bit mean, but I just said, "Well, you're a magician, you know, pull it out of thin air." And so, yes. But, so, you know, but it was fun to watch him work an audience or work a crowd. And, you know, he knew the effect he was having on people. And so this was just a small guy. I can't imagine what it would be like watching someone work with, like you were saying, the Solomon, or that is their bit. Yeah. It'd be a little scary, I think, to,
You know, and in some ways, it's almost like both the audience and the entertainer slash are in on it in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, the audience, while they, you know, I think a lot of people are so desperate to have answers, mm-hmm. you know, to these questions
yeah.
you know, in their lives, that even though they know it's, you know, it's a con, they want to be lied to, as long as it's something that, you know, is the right answer to their questions. You know, lie to yeah. me, please.
And I love that we are kind of let into it, because there's something the audience loves to feel as smart when these movies have twists. Like when yes. we finally catch on, we love the twist. We love the M. Night Shyamalan thing, or The Usual Suspects. We love it when these things happen, or Rollo Tomasi, you know, L.A. Confidential. We love knowing things, but it's fun when we feel like we're with the characters. So I do love that about the beginning of Nightmare Alley, when we learn how these work, you know, saying a yes. certain, like how the code works and how... Right. She gets a basket of questions, and then they give her a different basket and she sets it on fire. I thought that was really cool. And it goes to all of the research that he did that you were talking about. That's exciting. It's just like movies are supposed to lose you in the world. We feel like Gresham, he did the legwork and he lets us into it.
Right. It's also interesting when there's that very specific skill set that you think about old school burglars, and safe
Oh,
crackers,
yeah.
people like that that have their little kit of tools.
Yes.
And there was an author who passed away named Joe Gorse, who was an expert at this kind of thing. He wrote some
Okay.
really fun crime novels, but I remember him coming to the bookstore and he would bring his little kit of locks.
Oh, wow.
And I love that kind of old school kind of as I say, this is knowledge that it not everybody is privy to. So you're given a glimpse into this specialized skill set in
That's
some way.
what's so wonderful. Yeah, it's a way to experience parts of life and people that, you might cross the street to avoid in real life. You're not going to go want to hang out with burglars and hitmen and people that are doing these things, but in the safety of the page and in the safety of a movie, you feel like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to go down this nightmare alley. Yeah.
What did you think about if you had to? I was asking my wife this. Who is the most evil character in the book, if there is, or who's the worst character in the book in terms of
Ooh.
what they do? I know it's a tricky one.
That is a tricky one. I think Stan, maybe.
Okay.
He engineers, he's given all the warnings and either thinks he's going to outsmart things. Like, I did like that in the new version when he learns how a geek is made. He's horrified by it, and we see it in Bradley Cooper's eyes. And he's going to become it anyway. But I do think in the book, he's given all the information, all the warnings, kind of like, parents don't touch the oven when it's red and, a little kid is going to do it. But he's a grown man. And I do think in a way, but also he is someone who is his own worst enemy. He's helpless. He's born broken, essentially, or he's broken by his experiences. So it's a hard one. I also think the Lilith character is up
Yes.
there. What do you think? What did your wife think?
I think we both kind of dialed in on Lilith.
Yeah. Because she has more of her, you would hope, her psychological faculties and her position and yeah.
Well, I mean,
You'd hope.
as somebody who's been in therapy, been in therapy, and seen psychologists, and what she does with her patient confidentiality and
Oof,
all that shit
my
is
God.
just, and uses
Horrifying.
it against them. It's pretty horrifying, but and also pretty ingenious, how
Yeah.
she works it out.
Yeah, kind
And
of
it
like
seems
what
to me,
carnies do, like immediately sizing people up.
that's right. I mean, and that's why they both identify that in each other, that they're both
Yeah.
really the two sides of the same coin and using the same techniques. She just happens to do a double jujitsu move on him,
Yep.
and she, but one of the things about
Yeah, I would
one
say
of
as a doctor, that's yeah.
it's pretty
Yeah.
skeezy.
I know. Yeah,
But it is.
one of my favorite uncles, he had been a police officer, he'd been in Vietnam, and then he didn't like being a police officer, so he went back to school and he became a therapist to work with vets. And so you want to think of like people going into it for the right reasons. People like my Uncle Joel,
Right.
who that he was a fascinating guy because he loved movies. But then, so he had this hard day job, and then every Christmas he would take a job just like for fun in department stores as a gift wrapper, just to like make people smile and get a little, like he needed that break. And so, yeah, I think Lilith is the epitome of like the evil that people are putting their trust in this woman, and oh my God.
But in the new film, and again, Cate Blanchett is just perfectly cast, and you know, she can do it, and it had such style, you know.
I love her. That he sized her up right away with the gun and feeling powerful. I love
that's
that.
Right. I know, that was so great. Mm-hmm. But we get a little bit, because she obviously, of course, has her backstory too.
Oh yeah,
and. Mm-hmm. I don't believe, I may have skimmed over the Lilith part a little bit too fast. I don't believe she reveals much about that in the book. Maybe
I don't think so either. I was going to ask you if I missed it as well. I think Guillermo and Kim kind of made sure they did, right? I think it's interesting what they did with her.
Yeah, they added that scar.
Yes, which isn't really explained, and you know.
No, I thought that was really key.
Yeah.
One of the things about Stan is that women seem to be simply a means to an end with him.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point.
He does have a lot of classic kind of narcissist traits, in that he really doesn't feel, at least from what I can tell, he's not really capable of feeling much for Molly.
No.
I mean, he plays
I feel like
the role.
He was more attracted to her genuinely in the original, but then gets over that. Although they have that beautifully romantic scene on the carousel in the new one that I liked.
Where they dance a little
bit. Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah, yeah no, it, but was but he then, just playing a role?
Yes. And then once he has her, it's like, that old thing of she's there, he wants, and then, well, I had her, now we're moving on. Yeah.
Or she's the one that, you know, yeah, she's the one that's going to take me where I want to go.
Yeah.
And we're mm-hmm. She knows the code as well as I do, you know.
In the book, he's even more ruthless. Like, well, also the old one, though, you know, you flubbed it. And I think that might be in the new one too. You fluffed it, but in the book, it's like, well, you need to go over these before you go to sleep tonight. And also, he's withholding sex in the book in a way. It's more manipulative, and he knows how to use these women, I guess. Yeah,
he's withholding it in the book, you said?
It seemed like it, yeah, because she was wanting it, or wanting them to be closer a little bit, and he was working it, sleeping with her when he needed her to be pliable, is what I was getting in a couple moments. Yeah,
right. And then but in the book, and certainly in the new film, it seems like it's really Xena who drives him crazier physically.
Oh yeah, yeah,
because you know, A, mm-hmm. she's experienced and she knows what the hell to do, you know, and
he's completely caught off guard. Yeah.
And also they are, you know, they are alike. You know, they're
And in the book, you get that she's the one who takes his virginity. Yeah.
And that,
or it's kind of implied. Yeah.
Right. And then in the book, he takes Molly's virginity.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So a couple of differences too, I was thinking about with the book and both versions. Let me see. In the original film, it's an accident with Pete.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, you know, it's hard. I think it is an accident. Yeah.
I think it is an accident. It's not an accident in the book and the new version. I think they're very clear that Pete's going to, or Pete stands in his way of, mm-hmm. you know, of the code and where he wants to go next. And I think the new version really shows
the ruthlessness,
mm-hmm. more of a ruthlessness, and that he'll kill if he has to.
Yep.
And possibly, do you think that they tamed that down? Because noir doesn't shy away from those kinds of things.
No.
Even back in the film. Do you think they tamed that part down and made it a little bit more ambiguous because of Tyrone Power, this sort of beefcake?
I would think maybe the Hays Code and stuff. I think Tyrone Power would have wanted it.
He would have been on board, you think?
He would have been on board, but probably, yeah, they needed to.
We can't make him that sinister.
Yes. And, and that's sort of funny because now that's still an actor thing, especially like movie star guys and they want to get work. Leading men, they don't want to play anything that's going to be too anti-heroic. Just like leading ladies. Oh, if my character's mean, people are going to hate me, that kind of thing. And so I always love that about noir. They just lean right into that. Yep.
Lean right in. Mm-hmm. And also, Ezra Grendel or Grindel, yeah. How it's spelled in the book. That's an interesting. Why did they make that change from Grendel, the dragon in Beowulf, right? from Grindel in the book. We could read too much into that, but.
Some of the names were great. Yeah.
Yes. But in the new film, he kills him very brutally. And they show us, mm-hmm. How he does it. Mm-hmm. And in the original film, he knocks him down.
Yep.
And it's not, we don't know whether he died as a result. We don't think so. It doesn't mm-hmm. look like he did. And in the book, he definitely did not kill him.
No. Because then later. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Grendel that, gets him on the run.
Yep.
With, with an able assist from Lilith.
Yeah. That's an interesting double cross. That was interesting, too, the way Lilith was going to gaslight and try to get him institutionalized. Like, my goodness. Yeah.
It was great, too. I mean, they did it in both film versions in slightly different ways.
Yep.
In the original, I thought it was so great when you hear the cop siren.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't hear anything. And then, yeah, that was so well done.
Yeah. What I was thinking about listening to you talk earlier when you were bringing up Lilith was this was around the time the Hitchcock movie Spellbound came out, where which used Salvador Dali and it was Ingrid Bergman using therapy to cure and fix Gregory Peck, who's broken. And here she's using what she can to try to break him more. And so it's like these things happen around the same time. Yeah. These two different looks. Yeah.
Boy, fascinating. There's just so much. I mean, once you start really digging in, there's just so much going on.
Yeah. I am so glad that you inspired me to read the book because I had not. Yeah.
And it just, it makes you really curious. I've read a little bit about Gresham. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, the poor guy had a pretty tragic end. When he was, 53?
Yes. Old? What?
I think he was just like in his early 50s, 53.
Yes, took his own life. He was in the same hotel room where he'd written Nightmare Alley, I read. Although I think it was Imogen Sarah Smith said years later there was some indication that he might have had cancer or a terminal. Yes. There might have been, some stuff.
Right, I read that mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
There's really...
It's just sad.
Mm-hmm. One thing else I wanted to show you, if I could grab it. Centipede Press.
Okay.
Is this sort of specialty press. They came out a couple of years ago with this just amazing, sorry, it's so glinty, but this two-volume set of Nightmare Alley. And it has all this extra cool stuff inside, various pieces, all the original posters and mm-hmm. the different covers that it's had over the years.
Yes, I loved that one cover that you just had up. I think it's also, they show it on the Criterion disc, where it would be the Mary character in her pink leotard, essentially. Yeah. Some of the book covers over the year. It's
Oh,
pulpier.
right. I think I might have that somewhere, that old paperback cover. This is the one you're talking about right there.
It's such a, I love old covers. Yep. Yeah.
Me too. But you wonder, you know, as I said at the beginning, you know, Gresham was obviously a real seeker. And, you know, he tried a lot of these different things. And he, you know, he was a devotee of the tarot card, became fascinated with them. And I do find it interesting that he, you know, shows all these different things in not a very, you know, they're all just kind of different grifts and cons. That sort of exploit people's weaknesses and their vulnerabilities.
Yes, I did like the way they used tarot. I'm, you know, complete novice. I don't know anything about it. As small aside for anyone listening, I saw Megan Abbott post recently, there is a pulp tarot deck, like a Pulp Fiction style, old. Yes, it was on one of her social media. I want to say Instagram. So you might have to go check that out. It might have been one of her stories, but I don't know anything about it. But I did like the way that tarot was used as these are your cards, but you don't have to do that. You can make your own choices. There's a little bit of existentialism there, like, you know, fate and free will. He has free will, but he's just going to keep making these mistakes. Yeah.
Yes, I know. My wife does. She has a tarot deck, and you know, she'll do little readings for fun.
Oh, fun!
You know, occasionally. Yeah. No, it's fascinating stuff, and the other one is the I Ching. You know, some of that sort of divination and. Let's see. Anything else that we can?
I can't think of anything. Before I let you go, any other noir, either modern or classic, or anything you want to recommend? I know you're always reading stuff, because this episode will come up. I think it will actually go up next week. So anything out or on the horizon that you want to recommend people seek out, and they should be sure to order any books, of course, from Poison Pen online.
Poison Pen, we wouldn't argue with that. That would be great. Let's see. Well, you know, noir these days is one of those terms that's sort of applied to everything. I just did a program with a guy named Brian Panowich, who has a new book out called Nothing But the Bone. Set in Northern Georgia. And it's really excellent. Would recommend him. He wrote an earlier book called Bull Mountain. It's great. Let's see what else. One
or
of my
just
favorite
crime that you love, any new crime fiction.
Richard Lang is one of my favorite writers. And he wrote, did you happen to read this last book that he wrote called Rovers?
No.
And it is like, I think it didn't get the attention that deserves. In an email, Jen and I were talking about The Lost Boys and Fright
Near
Night.
Near Dark and great. Fright Night. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is a kind of a hard-boiled noir vampire novel.
Oh,
that
wow.
Was set in the late 70s. And a lot of it's set here in Phoenix.
How exciting.
It's a great book. But he has a new, I've always liked what he does. And he has a new book coming out called Joe Hustle.
Okay.
And I'm going to be doing an event, virtual event with him coming up. Who else? Scott Phillips has a new book coming out. Mm-hmm. I just got the ARC of that. I really like him. The Ice Harvest that they made the film version out of. He wrote the book to that.
Yeah, he's good friends with one of my friends, Jed Ayers. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. I've never met him.
I would love him. Yeah.
And then let's see, you know, some of the old classics are coming out. Walter Mosley has a new E.Z. Rollins book coming out this month, and he'll
Very
be coming
cool.
back to the bookstore. Our mutual friend Ace Atkins has a really interesting new book that, you know,
he was comparing it to Charade, which I love. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think he said Memphis set Charade. Yeah, don't let the devil ride.
Don't let the devil ride. And it there are some things in it that something, you know, different voices and different kinds of fiction that we're not used to hearing from, you know, seeing from Ace so far. You know, there's an era of there's a bit of international intrigue in it, for instance.
Yeah, he wanted to embrace some spy fiction, which is exciting. Yeah.
It's really cool. Yeah, so I can't wait to see him again. He's going to be back in town. There's just so much good stuff coming out. It's really
Yeah.
a great period.
Yeah, we should let everyone know that Poison Pen has a wonderful, they have a Facebook presence. They're all over social media, but also YouTube. So whenever there's a live event or a Zoom event, you're going to be able to watch it later on YouTube. Patrick and I co-hosted and interviewed our friend Dwayne Swarzynski for California Bear. You can watch that video. I'll link to all of these things when I post, but be sure to check out all of the stuff going on at the Pen. I always love going to the events, and you know, you're such a noir scholar, so it's great learning
you.
From you. Yeah, and I
well,
was
I would
just
love
glad we could do this.
I would love to get you down and participate in more events.
Oh, that would be so much fun.
That was so much fun to do that. That was so much
Yeah,
fun.
it was a blast.
And you know, and we know a lot of people in common.
Yeah.
I think I first met you when Megan Abbott was in town.
Yes, we went over to Hotel Valley Ho after and had some French fries. Yeah.
Yes.
She was in town for Beware the Woman. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.